right, so I have a problem. The problem is that some fraction of you, which I don't know but was roughly estimated as 50%, are initiates and maybe 50% aren't. And so I will try to handle both groups and talk about controlling gene expression in immune cells and neurons, starting off by describing one transcription factor, one protein that controls the expression of a gene and controls the expression of, as you'll see, many genes, and show that that's tied into immune responses, and then ask whether the same system might be playing a role in neurons, in particular in allowing neurons to learn about their role in the larger scheme of things. And I'll try to develop evidence that it does play that role. Now, gene control is really the central, at least from my perspective, the central event in biology. There's a whole range of regulatory proteins. They bind to DNA, or they bind to proteins that are bound to DNA, and they activate or repress, but I won't talk about repression at all, I'll just talk about activation, the formation of RNA replicas of specific genes. So those regulators, since they regulate which cells express a given gene, which cell, how much protein comes from that gene, how much RNA comes from that gene, they themselves must be regulated, and that's a whole field of study. But I'm just going to concentrate on one form of regulation, and that takes advantage of the fact that the DNA is in the nucleus of the cell, and it's surrounded by cytoplasm, and cytoplasm, from this point of view, could be considered as a storage vesicle for storing transcriptional regulators in an inactive form. And the one I'll talk about is, in fact, stored that way and activated to move into the nucleus. So activation or regulation involves very much the release from tethering in the cytoplasm. Well, it's not literally tethering. Release from storage in the cytoplasm and movement to the nucleus. And we call the factor NF-kappa B for reasons that I needn't go into. So the first thing I want to talk about is the work of a postdoctoral fellow in my laboratory, Alexander Hoffman, soon to be an assistant professor in San Diego, who teamed up with a computational guy, biologist, I guess, interested in biology, at Caltech, named Andrei Levchenko, who is now at Johns Hopkins. And they got interested in certain regularities in the behavior of the NF-kappa B system. And by system, as I'll show you in a moment, what I mean is the interaction of NF-kappa B with an inhibitor protein, I-kappa B. So, the cytoplasm here, light blue, or green, or whatever that is, and the nucleus here, dark blue, represent the regulation that I'm talking about. And NF-kappa B is a dimer of related but different proteins, something we needn't go into in any detail. And it ordinarily is found bound to an inhibitor protein, I-kappa B. And as you will see, there are three of those that are relevant, any one of which does the same thing that I'll describe. And as such, it is inactive. It cannot bind to DNA even if it gets into the nucleus, and it does sort of cycle through the nucleus occasionally. But it can't bind to DNA because of the binding of I-kappa B, and also it's found predominantly in the cytoplasm because of signals on the I-kappa B molecule. But lots and lots of things lead to the degradation of I-kappa B, and that's the central regulatory event, is the degradation of the protein. And by degrading the protein, it releases NF-kappa-B. And NF-kappa-B has, particularly up here in this diagrammatic way, a very powerful nuclear localization signal that was masked in the complex. And so it moves now freely into the nucleus, where it binds to DNA, and bound to DNA, it leads to the activation of specific genes. And so the big question is, where does it bind to DNA? And it binds to very specific recognizable sites in DNA, the nature of which I needn't go into, which are found around a whole range of genes. And we'll come back to that range of genes a little later. So there are a lot of target genes in the DNA. And those genes, we know from lots of work now over this, we discovered this more than 15 years ago, there's been a lot of work on it, are genes involved in cell survival. All cells have within them the seeds of their own destruction, a suicide mechanism, won the Nobel Prize this year, that suicide mechanism, called apoptosis. And in fact, what NF-kappa-B does generally is to suppress that response so that cells survive better than they would without it. And if you knock out the genes for NF-kappa-B, cells tend to die every time you activate them in almost any way because they lack this survival. It's also involved in inflammation and immune responses, we'll come back to, and growth and proliferation. Now, what leads to the degradation? So the whole control here is something called the IKK complex. And the IKK complex is a number of proteins which lead to, whose activation lead to putting some phosphate groups on I-kappa-B. The phosphates on I-kappa-B signal a protein degradation system. It gets degraded. So the key issue is just transferring phosphate onto I-kappa-B. And what can make that happen? A whole range of signals that cells get. And those signals have in common that they are in some way or another noxious. They're either noxious to the cell, they're dangerous to the cell, or they are noxious to the organism, like activation of the immune system by a bacterium or a virus. So lipopolysaccharide is brought in by bacteria. It's one way that cells recognize that there has been a bacterial infection of the organism. Antigens on immune cells will activate NF-kappa-B through the IKK complex on B cells or T cells, lymphocytes. But your ordinary garden variety cell has a receptor on its surface for something called TNF. And when TNF is released in the body, and that happens when we get infections or inflammatory responses, the TNF will go to almost all the cells in the body and activate NF-kappa-B through the IKK complex. And it's part of the response that we have to infection. Ultraviolet light will do this, virus infections will do this, even oxygen radicals generated inside cells will do this. But mostly it's receptors on the surface of the cell recognizing something in the circulation that leads, that's something you don't want to happen, right? There, no, it's all right. I've been talking about one slide too much is the answer to that. Which leads to the activation of NF-kappa-B. Now, I-kappa-Bs come in three forms, and they're just called alpha, beta, and epsilon. They're lost in history. they have existed. And there are some repeats in them which make them recognizable. It's not important for our purposes to worry about what the structure is. But the three of them are structurally related. Each one can be phosphorylated and proteolytically degraded by the same IKK system. However, they're not interchangeable because we've knocked out the genes for each of these. And each one gives a separate phenotype. So they have specific roles. And really, in a sense, the question that we're asking is, what can we learn about those specific roles? We've also made cells that lack alpha, beta, and epsilon, and those cells cannot control NF-kappa B, so there is no other I-kappa B. And the question is, are they responsive to different stimuli? The answer to that, for a first approximation, is no, they're not, because, and here let me just talk about methodology for a minute. You can take a cell population and extract from the nucleus of the cell the proteins and ask whether there's any protein in there that will bind to the NF-kappa B binding sites, so-called kappa B site. And then you can display those by displaying the bound sites. And the answer is there aren't any. So here's a cell resting in a culture dish, and it has virtually no detectable NF-kappa B in the nucleus. But you treat that cell for 10 minutes with TNF-alpha with an activator, and now you can see a lot of it. And so, very rapidly, all of the events that I described to you, the phosphorylation, degradation, movement to the nucleus, happen. So this is a rapid response system. I mean, in bacteria, this wouldn't be so rapid. But in mammalian cells, this is about as fast as things get in terms of real physiological responses. And you can see what happens to epsilon, beta, and alpha, because we can look at each one of those using antibodies, and they're all present at zero time, and by 10 minutes, they're all degraded. Beta's a little slower to be degraded. Reproducibly, alpha's fastest to be degraded. And if we activate the cells with any one of these three activators, we see the same thing. With LPS, it's a little slower. They don't all degrade so rapidly. They don't necessarily all go away so well. IL-1, which is another inflammatory response protein, activates very rapid degradation. But what you see is, in the two cases where it's rapid enough to really be able to get the resolution, is that I-kappa B alpha comes back after an hour or so. And then it goes away again. And so there's a sort of two-hour periodicity to its formation, loss, and to the formation and then loss of I-kappa B. And that's mirrored by a periodicity in the appearance of NF-kappa B, which is here for 30 minutes, by an hour virtually gone, starts coming back at 90 minutes, but then stays on thereafter, and this goes out to 6 hours. It's not a linear scale. The same thing is true with IL-1. With lipopolysaccharides, as I said, it's just not synchronous enough to see the phenomenon. And that's what got us interested in asking about the regulation of the system, the fact that you could see this synthesis and the degradation and resynthesis. So the first thing is that all three act together. There's no evidence that there's anything stimulus specific. That is, you might have imagined that IL-1 would knock out one of these inhibitors and TNF another one, and we've never seen that in any system. This is just a few of the systems that have been looked at. But it looks like I-kappa B alpha is feedback controlled, and that the others aren't, and that's a fact. And in fact, if you look at the I-kappa B alpha gene, you can see that it has a binding site for NF-kappa B in it. So NF-kappa B is released, moves into the nucleus, one of the genes it activates is its own inhibitor. And that's the nature of the feedback system. And this just basically says that any sort of input to the system leads to an output of free NF-kappa B, and that in turn leads to the activation of the alpha gene, which then goes back. And what it actually does, it's synthesized out here in the cytoplasm, because that's where all proteins are made. But it goes back into the nucleus and binds to NF-kappa B either free or in fact can literally release it from DNA. And that's why, in fact, the protein is all gone. In fact, the genes that were activated would be turned off at that point. And you can describe this, and here I apologize to all of you mathematically literate who enjoy equations, but I'm not going to go into the mathematics of this at all, and you'll appreciate that I didn't. But you can describe this by some simple equations. Equations for the production of the output, equations for the feedback, the production of the feedback inhibitor. And it's pretty evident that with the right parameters, you would see this as a continual oscillation. And there aren't, over a period of time, which would in this case be 6 or 8 hours, there are very few biologic systems that show any kind of periodicity like this. But of course, I showed you what you get, and you don't really get a periodicity like that. You see the first wave, and then it sort of peters out. And I might say, for those interested, that this is no peculiarity. The cells we used in the previous experiments are all fibroblastic cells growing in culture. You can do it with T cells, with monocytes, or with fibroblasts. You get the same kind of inhibition followed by resynthesis. And there are lots of parameters now that you would need to specify in order to make a model of this whole thing. You'd need this constitutive rates of synthesis, the messenger RNA half-lives, that is, the translation rates. These would be constant for beta and epsilon, but for alpha, then you need the increased rate, which should be a function of the square of the NF-kappa B concentration, since it's a dimeric protein. And we treat NF-kappa B as a constant in all of this, which is a reasonable simplification. And then you need binding constants for the various factors and half-lives for the various factors. In fact, there's something sort of interesting about that, which is that the I-kappa Bs have very, very short half-lives unless they bind to NF-kappa B. And that's, as you can see, probably a necessity of the system. And you need a variety of other constants, including transport rates and whatever else. So you can estimate most of those parameters. There's actually a surprising amount of data in the literature that allows you to at least get a reasonable ballpark for most of those numbers. And so we started modeling what would happen. We had modeled, sorry, I showed you before, what would happen with only I kappa B alpha, which is you should get a continual oscillation. And we tested that by making cells in which beta and epsilon were knocked out, were not present. And if you do that, what you see is a very nice continual oscillation. So there's no question but that that oscillatory behavior is real, and but it has to be revealed, because if you make cells that have only beta in them or only epsilon in them, then you see a slow appearance of NF-kappa B, and it's constant over time, at least for quite a while. So you get this kind of a behavior for it. And it really is the combination of these two that lead to the way the system activates, and is the reason that in a wild-type cell, this oscillation damps very quickly, because the system becomes dominated by beta and epsilon. And these are just, you can then turn these into mathematical equations. And this is, again, now at very high time resolution, what happens in a wild-type cell. You get the first peak of the oscillation, then you just begin to see a little bit of the later ones. And that's a consequence of alpha coming on, but now beta and epsilon coming on, and just because they're continually made, they're like any other gene in the cell. So why does this happen? Why regulate it in two different ways and get a damped oscillation? I think the answer is in the next simulation. Because there are two very, very important properties of the system. One is that it responds more or less the same to a short pulse and a long pulse of activator. Since the degradation is so rapid, it really doesn't matter whether you treat the cells for 10 minutes or 15 minutes or 30 minutes or 60 minutes. You see little differences in the peaks, but it's a small effect. Fundamentally, it goes on for half an hour and goes off over the next half hour and then is off forever if you just give a pulse of inducer, like TNF for 10 minutes or 15 minutes. And that means that there has to be a very fast regulatory component. But a fast regulatory component like that, as I showed you, leads to an oscillation. So that if you want to be able to have the same system go on and stay on stably over time, then you've got to have some other way of maintaining stable production. And that's where the other two inhibitors come in. The second thing is that in principle should allow the system to regulate two different kinds of genes. Genes that turn on rapidly should go on no matter what the pulse length. Genes that only go on after a long period of time, that have a lag of 2 hours or more, will only go on if the inducer remains and will be insensitive to pulses. And also, I might say, insensitive to adventitious activation, which may happen, although we don't know much about it. This just shows that that was a prediction. This shows the data for it, 5 minutes, 15 minutes, 30 minutes, 60 minutes. In fact, reproduces what you would expect. And it's really not necessary to go into that. Okay, now the first prediction is true, that is, the system is very quickly turned off and turned off stably after a pulse, but is more or less insensitive to pulse length. The second thing is, can we find genes that are activated here and genes that are activated here? All right, so here's the patterns of NF-kappa-B activation in a persistent induction and in a 15-minute pulse. I don't need to go into all the predictions. And this is in cells that lack I-kappa-B alpha, because one of the predictions was that this all depends on I-kappa-B alpha, and it does. In a 15-minute pulse without I-kappa-B alpha in a cell that lacks it, you're dominated by beta and epsilon, and NF-kappa-B stays on for a long period of time until they're made. So here are two genes. One of the genes is GAPDH. It's a gene which is not regulated by NF-kappa-B. There's as much synthesis of the protein in unactivated cells as there is in cells activated for any length of time. It's just totally insensitive. The system acts as a control to show that we're analyzing the same amount of cells in all cases. IP10 is a chemokine gene known to be turned on very rapidly after TNF treatment of cells, starts going on at 30 minutes, stays on in persistently activated cells for 8 hours. In pulsed cells, it goes on at roughly the same time, maybe at a somewhat lower level, and stays on all through the experiment. In the absence of I-kappa-B alpha, you see basically the same thing to a first approximation. But the Rantes gene, which is another chemokine, and I can't tell you biologically why it should be true that it behaves so different, but it behaves enormously differently. It does not become detectable until 2 hours after treatment of the cells, and really is robustly made only after 4 hours or more. Therefore, in a 15-minute pulse, it never turns on, because the NF-kappa-B is gone from the cell before the gene is ready to respond. Now, what goes on during these 4 hours, I might say this has nothing to do with the synthesis of new protein. You can do exactly the same thing if you block the synthesis of new protein. So this is all the existing proteins in the cell. What are they doing for 2 hours or 4 hours before the gene goes on? They're probably reorganizing the structure of the proteins that are bound to the gene, the chromatin proteins that are bound to the gene. But in any case, you need that period of time before NF-kappa-B can really activate the gene, and if it's not there, it doesn't do it. Now, you see a different behavior in the mutant where it goes on independent of whether it's a short pulse or a long synthesis, because it hangs on long enough to activate the gene. So you can get two quite different behaviors in the same cell to the same activator, whether it's a pulse of activation or it's a persistent activation. And again, I think the system is designed to do that. It's not an accident. All right. I've shown you two or three genes. How many genes are activated by NF-kappa-B? And what are those genes? Well, so we did a chip experiment. We did this a while ago when there were 10,000 genes available from the mouse genome. This is all done with mouse cells. And we could detect activity, transcriptional activity, in about 80% of those genes. But some of them, the data wasn't consistent enough, so we actually only looked at about 60% of the genes. And here's a very simple plot of the amount of product from a given gene with or without TNF induction. And most genes, the result centers around one, that is, there's no detectable induction. It's a sort of Gaussian around one, but with a long forward tail and with some back tail too, which I'm not going to go into. I said I wouldn't talk about repression, and we've never actually investigated much about that. But if you look at this tail, there are genes out here that are induced 30-fold or more by treatment with TNF. And how many genes are there? Well, it depends on what cutoff you take, and it depends on how you want to draw the background. So I don't actually know the answer to the question, but you can get a rough idea of the answer, because out here, most of this is going to be real data. There's 100, another 50 genes out here, so maybe 150 genes. Some significant fraction of these are going to be real. Many people in an experiment like this take twofold as a cutoff, although that's clearly there's a tail below that. So the answer is that of this 6,000 genes, some few hundred are activated. There are some 30,000 genes in the genome, maybe more than that. So we're talking about many thousands of genes that are under this control. That's TNF. Now, how many of those require NF-kappa-B? We can answer that question by doing exactly the same thing in cells that are mutant for NF-kappa-B. They can't make NF-kappa-B. And I won't tell you exactly how we got to that, but we have such cells. And now you can take cells that were induced, genes that were induced more than 2.5-fold, more than 4-fold, more than 6-fold. We have all of these genes here, the numbers here, they're slightly different than the numbers on the other slide because of the way the cutoffs were changed. Of these 378 genes that show more than 2.5-fold induction, 321 of them show no induction at all if you get rid of the NF-kappa-B system. So to a first approximation, almost all the genes that are activated by TNF require NF-kappa-B. That gives an idea of how potent this factor is, and what the nature of the cell response is when you activate it. And the rest of this is just different ways of looking at these numbers. So what genes are there? Because each gene has a name, and we can go through. And we just grouped them here, and I'm not going to talk about any specific gene. I'll just talk about the groups. There are genes that are involved in autoregulation. I-kappa-B alpha, of course, is one of those that the only one I've talked about here, but there are lots of genes that control either the NF-kappa B system itself or the TNF system, and some genes about which we know very little. There are genes that are involved in cell survival, in apoptosis. And oddly, there are genes involved both positively and negatively, although the major response to NF-kappa B is negative. There are lots of genes involved in inflammation, some very well-known gene, like the TNF-alpha gene itself. So it auto-stimulates the cell. Many chemokines and other genes involved in inflammatory responses. Genes involved in innate immunity and genes involved in adaptive immunity. So from just this picture, you get an idea what this factor is for. It's protective of cells. Oh, wait, I have one more set of genes to look at. There are genes involved in growth control and genes involved in what is called the immediate early response, which is a way that cells reorganize themselves to go from being quiescent, which these cells are that we're starting with, to being activated in some way to grow or to make products or in the nervous system for that matter, to be carriers of information. So you get an idea what this system is for. It's for inducing growth. It's for reprogramming the cell for activation. It's for protecting the cell against cell death. It's helping the cell play a role in inflammatory responses and immune responses. Now, that was all expected, actually, because there'd been enough data on individual genes and individual situations that we sort of suspected that that's what you would see. But a postdoc of mine, Molly Mefford, and I, sort of independently, she wrote to me and said she wanted to come and do this, and I had meanwhile been thinking about it, said, look, this is a fabulous system for use in the nervous system. And maybe it works there. And what might it do? Well, it might do what it does in other cells. It might protect them against cell death, so that when you have activation of nervous transmission, the cell doesn't die as a consequence of all this activation. And that's a real worry. It might help in some kind of immune response or inflammatory responses in the brain. I don't know. But that would all be uninteresting. That would say it's doing the same thing in a neuron that it's doing in the other kinds of cells where we've looked at it. What was really interesting was that this is a carrier of information from the cytoplasm to the nucleus. That if an event occurs in the cytoplasm, you can imagine the nucleus reprogramming the genes that are on as a consequence of that event in the cytoplasm. That's in fact what NF-kappa B does. And there's a very important phenomenon in the nervous system where that could play a very, very big role. And that is in the learning process that a neuron goes through. So neurons clearly know when they've been activated and adapt themselves. They become better carriers of information. There are phenomena known as LTP and other things which sort of enshrine those notions. But as a general statement, the neuron is a plastic cell in that it changes its properties as a consequence of electrical and chemical stimulation. So could NF-kappa B play a role in that? Here it is in the cytoplasm, which is where stimulation occurs. So Molly, working with a bright, recent Stanford graduate, working in the lab for a couple of years as a technician, Jolene Chang, with some help from Howard Schulman, who's at Stanford, or was at Stanford, and particularly with the very important help of Michael Fanslow, who is a behavioral, who studies the behavior of mice, rodents, at UCLA, we've looked at these questions. So the first thing, and these are things that we knew before we got started, is the brain does have a high level of NF-kappa-B. In fact, it's been one of those anomalies that although we study it everywhere else but in the brain, that's the place it's probably at highest concentration. It's present in neurons, but it's also present in glia, which are the supporting cells of the brain. And it is found throughout the cells. And there has been a suggestion that it may be particularly localized at synapses, and I'll come back to synapses in a minute. And it was known already that things that damage neurons activate NF-kappa-B, that it is part of a response to damage. Hypoxia, lack of oxygen, infections, overexcitement. You can treat neurons with so much neurotransmitter that they burst with excitement. Beta amyloid involved in pathologic processes. And people had taken neurons out of the brain and put them in culture and then assayed for NF-kappa-B, and they found it was constitutively activated in cultured cells. It didn't seem to need a stimulus for activation. And our interpretation of that, and I'll show you that that's true, is that when you put neurons in culture, they make connections with each other. And so they were all exciting each other in the culture dish, and this constitutive activation was actually due to nervous stimulation in the neuronal cultures. And let me remind you, and this is the only picture I could come up with last night of a neuron. As you'll see, it's part of another experiment, and it's not a very good way of illustrating it, but the best I have. So a neuron has a cell body. That's where the nucleus is. That's where the mitochondria, that's where most of the sort of normal cellular behavior is. But it also has lots of processes, and you can see some of them here. You can see a very long dendritic process here. And of course, neurons have two kinds of processes. They have dendritic processes which receive information, and they have axonal processes, which you can't see well here at all, which send information. And this is actually one cell in a whole dish of cells, but it happens to be green and the other cells aren't green, so you see this cell and you don't see the others. But all along here, there are axonal processes coming in making contact. And they make contact at what are called synapses. So the synapse is a place where the axon and the dendrite talk to each other and where chemical stimulation turns into electrical stimulation. Now, for our purposes, it can be looked at in this way. This is the axonal process coming in, activated by something, releasing a neurotransmitter. And the major positive neurotransmitter in the brain is a simple amino acid, glutamate. So it releases glutamate. And there are now here is the other half of the synapse, the dendrite. And the dendrites have these little spines on them. The spines contain lots and lots of receptors for glutamate and other things. But let's just worry about glutamate. So the glutamate is released here, binds to these receptors, and what does it do as a consequence of that? The only thing we need to worry about now for this discussion is that you get a rise in calcium in the dendritic spine, a very localized rise in calcium, and people have imaged this rise, and you can see it as a local event in the spine head around the synapse. You can also shave cells very easily and make preparations which consist solely of synapses. I'll show you why I say that later. So if you're getting a rise in calcium, what could calcium do to let the cell know that it's been stimulated? That's right. We want to talk now about the learning by the cell of the fact that it's been stimulated. Well, there are two kinds of calcium-activated enzymes. There are calcium-dependent phosphatases and calcium-dependent kinases, and those are known to be major actors in cell responses. Kinases put phosphate on, phosphatases take phosphate off. So if NF-kappa-B were here, and it is there, The thing that's most interesting is whether the kinases, the things that phosphorylate, lead to I-kappa-B phosphorylation and degradation. That just makes pictures. All right, now, I said if you take a culture of cells and you just have normal background synaptic activity, it activates NF-kappa-B. So we take a culture of cells and we look for NF-kappa-B, and now instead of showing you spots, I'm showing you bar graphs, and you get a certain amount of NF-kappa-B protein constitutively in the cells. And we want to ask, is that due to background synaptic activity? So there are lots of inhibitors, chemical inhibitors known, that inactivate the background activity. And they have wonderful initials like TTX and APV, and I'm not even going to pretend to know what all of these are. But they're used by neuroscientists routinely. And what you can see is that they quiet down a lot of that activity. So a lot of that, the spontaneous NF-kappa-B that's in cells, is actually due to spontaneous electrical activity in the cultures, and it can be quieted down. So in all the experiments that I'll show you, we have quieted it down. Because if we didn't do that, there would be no experiment. I might say that we, just before doing the experiment, we release the inhibitors so that the cell now becomes responsive. So under those conditions, if you make a neuronal preparation, you look for NF-kappa-B, you see a little bit of NF-kappa-B. But if you activate the cells, and let's say we activate them with glutamate at a physiological level, this is not a lot of glutamate, it's the normal amount that they would see, then you activate NF-kappa-B. So NF-kappa-B is responsive. Does it have to do with calcium? Well, we just let calcium into the cells with a calcium ionophore. Yes, it activates. And however, there's not just this form of NF-kappa-B. There's a second form, which is a homodimer of P50 subunits. We needn't worry about what that is. But it's a second form, and I'll show you why I point it out later. And then we've done a lot of experiments using various kinds of inhibitors to ask, is there a kinase involved here? And the answer, without going through all of the various inhibitors, is yes, there's a kinase known to be at very high concentration in synapses, or in spines, which is called calcium calmodulin activated kinase 2. And if you inhibit it, you don't activate NF-kappa-B. So, yes, there is a calcium-activated kinase. It is on the road to activation of NF-kappa-B, and you can inhibit it and show it that way. You can show the need for calcium by treatment with EGTA, and you can also show that inhibitors of phosphatases have no role, which is what is shown here. And that's important because one could have imagined particularly the calcineurin was involved, and it doesn't seem to be. So then we use the methodologies that allow you to prepare synapses, just pure synapses. And if you then don't stimulate them, you see just a little bit of NF-kappa-B there. These are from quiescent cultures. And now we treat the synapses with glutamate, and you activate NF-kappa-B. So the activation of NF-kappa-B doesn't require a whole cell, it just requires these synaptic vesicles. You can do the same thing with Annamycin. You can do the same thing by depolarizing them with potassium. But the interesting thing is now we only get one form of NF-kappa-B. The other one that I showed you is not there. So the other form is not found at the synapses. The synapses have a really specifically accreted in one way or another just one form of NF-kappa-B. And we know that it's not because of lack of activation, because we can use a control preparation that activates the other form. And that's, I think that's very important, because what I believe it means is that both forms are made in the cell body. But one form is transported down the axon, down the dendrite to the synapse. And that transport is specific. It's not just a free diffusion, because if it were a free diffusion, this should be there too. And as I'll show you later, we can show that it, in fact, is tethered there. Do I need anything else? No. So, just to review what I've said, NF-kappa B is in neurons, is in synaptic vesicles, is induced by basal synaptic activity in cell cultures, but if you quiet that down, you can then show it's induced by glutamate treatment, by neuroactivating, an activating stimulus by a neurotransmitter, by NMDA, which is an analog of glutamate, or by depolarization, that simply elevating calcium is sufficient to get this, that calcineurin is not involved, and that calcium calmodulin kinase 2 is required for the activation. So, we get local activation. Can the NF-kappa B, which is localized, go to the nucleus? I've said it's way down in these processes. So how are we going to tell that? Well, we've now got to be able to visualize NF-kappa B. And this way we would like to have done it is with antibodies, but the antibodies that are around really don't work for this purpose. So we used a different trick, which is to make a DNA construct in which we'd link GFP to one of the subunits of NF-kappa B, so-called P65 subunit. And you can then take that DNA, which encodes this joint protein, and get it into neurons using what's called a gene gun. Its fancy name is ballistic transfection. But you coat it onto gold beads, and you shoot them into the cells. And enough DNA leaches off the gold beads to go into the nucleus and encode genes. So it's a way of sort of reprogramming the cell. Most of the other methods that are used in other kinds of cells don't work in neurons. And then what we do is use confocal microscopy of the living cells in a heated perfused chamber to follow NF-kappa B. And that picture that I showed you before is in fact of the green fluorescent protein distributed in a neuron after this ballistic transfection. And you can see that it distributes itself all through the long process and the short processes. And it actually goes up into the axonal processes, but they're not particularly evident. These are hippocampal neurons, which don't show much in the way of axonal process. Now, can all this stuff leave here and move into the nucleus? Actually, you can't tell from this picture because it's overexposed. But there's very little in the nucleus in the unactivated cell. And the answer is yes. Here's exactly the same cell, 45 minutes or so after treatment with glutamate. All of the P65, NF-kappa B, that was in the processes is gone. None of these processes show anything. And it's now accumulated in the nucleus, which glows green. So yes. Not only can you activate it locally, but it then moves into the nucleus. And you can actually do that with a relatively short pulse of activation. How about other kinds of cells? Well, the cell which might be most interesting is the glial cell. Glial cells, which we can make separate cultures of, have NF-kappa B distributed all through them in the same way, using the same material. And this is all a picture of the same cell after treatment with various concentrations of glutamate and waiting some 45 minutes, and there is no movement into the nucleus. So it requires a cell that has specific glutamate receptors on it. It's not just a response of all cells to glutamate. And just to be certain that this cell wasn't somehow dead, after that experiment was all done, we then treated it with TNF-alpha, which, as I said, all cells are stimulated by the first approximation. And now, over 60 minutes, it accumulates in the nucleus very nicely. All right, but we know that it moves into the nucleus, but is it moving in some polarized way through the dendrite that you can see? So we did the following experiment. Here's a different neuron. I'm just going to show you this part of it, it's in the box, in the dotted box, which is here, okay? And you can recognize this arm up here and this shaft coming down here. And what we did was to photo bleach the green color all through this region, which you can do pretty easily with lasers. And now, although the protein is still there, the fluorophore that's on the protein no longer is green. And you can see that here. So the part that was not bleached still remains green, but the part that was bleached, which is above this, which is above that point there, is no longer green. And actually, that arm over there is no longer green. And now, after bleaching it, we wait 10 minutes, and the area remains bleached. What that says is that there is no free diffusion of these molecules, or very slow free diffusion of the molecules, up from the unbleached area. Because if you calculate what free diffusion should give you, 10 minutes should be plenty to fill in that gap. But if you treat the cells for 10 minutes with MDA, which are with a glutamate analog, now you can see that it has moved up here, and it's actually moving in from the end of the other arm there too. And you can calculate a variety of numbers from this which are not very accurate and probably not worth talking about, but it is worth showing if you just stretch this out and look at it, how pretty it is. Here's the bleached end. You wait 10 minutes, nothing happens. 5 minutes with an MDA, 10 minutes with an MDA, and you can see the movement. And you can look at the other end of the bleached area, and I won't show it to you, but you don't get movement down from the top. It is a polarized movement. So not only was the P65, P50 subunits concentrated in the synapses, probably by movement down the dendrites, but now they move back up the dendrites in a polarized fashion, only if they've been released, only if I-kappa-B has been released. Right, I'm not going to worry about the numbers. Now, I was pretty happy with that, but other people who looked at it said, how do you know that the same molecule that was out in the synapse is actually gone into the nucleus? And it isn't that there are molecules in the cell body which go into the nucleus, and these molecules are just going up into the cell body but not actually making it to the nucleus. How do you know information actually flows from the synapse to the nucleus? So Molly undertook the somewhat more difficult job of bleaching the whole cell body. But you can do that, or virtually do it. So here is the bleached area is now the whole cell body. This is a blow-up of the same cell. You can actually see very nicely the processes on the cell that have NF-kappa-B in them. And here's the bleached cell body. It's virtually not green at all. You then wait 35 minutes. And in 35 minutes, there's a little bit of diffusion of NF-kappa-B into the cell body from the processes. So you now have about 26% more fluorescence than you had before. But if you treat with an MDA for 35 minutes, then you get a complete removal, of course, of all of the fluorescence from the processes. It moves into the cell body, and you can see that it concentrates in the nucleus. So now you have more than five times as much fluorescence as you had before activation. So there's no question but that the activation in the periphery leads to the movement of the information into the nucleus. Does it activate any genes? Yes, it does. So here we have stimulation of a cell culture with glutamate, and we look at a specific gene in the nucleus as to whether it's activated or not. In this case, the gene for BDNF, which is a well-known I forgot the name for them, but it's a protein involved in the nervous system responses. And it activates almost fivefold. If you do the same experiment in a mutant cell that lacks most NF-kappa B, actually not all, but most, then you get much less activation. The same thing is true of PSD95, another neuronal gene, virtually not activated at all in the absence of NF-kappa B. And then there are a variety of genes which are activated in other kinds of cells and in these cells, like FAS. That one is, to a first approximation, NF-kappa B independent, or CFOS, which is partially dependent, and I-kappa B alpha, which we talked about before, which is largely dependent on NF-kappa B. So yes, there are genes that are specific to neuronal situations that could be involved in the learning process. All right, so NF-kappa B activates a wide range of genes. Some are associated with synaptic function, some are just immediate response genes, other kinds of genes. We haven't done a complete sort of gene chip experiment here. We're in the process of doing it, but it's much more difficult in neurons for a variety of reasons. And one way to say this is that NF-kappa B functions as a calcium-responsive transcription factor, presumably working cooperatively with other transcription factors, because in mammalian cells, transcription factors very rarely work alone to modulate the adaptive responses to neuronal activity. So what's the consequence of this? Is it important for the animal that this be true? Well, we can make animals that lack almost all NF-kappa B. And we make them by knocking out the P65 gene. Without the P65 gene, you get virtually no NF-kappa B, but not absolutely none. If you knock out everything in the system, then the embryos don't grow and you can't get very far. So we can get an extensive knockout of NF-kappa B function. What do the animals look like? Well, they get terrible infections, and they actually would die in utero if we didn't protect them from suicide of liver cells. But we can protect them by putting them on a genetic background where that doesn't happen, and we can avoid the infections by putting them in antibiotic-treated water and being very careful about the animal quarters that they live in, the conditions that they live in. And then we can keep them for a year or so. And so we can make neuronal cultures from them. And if you make neuronal cultures from animals that lack P65, then you see no NF-kappa B at all in synaptic preparations. So whereas you ordinarily would see a low background level, stimulated level with glutamate, in the animals that lack that, you don't see anything at all. And you actually also don't see any I-kappa Bs, because as I said, the I-kappa B is only evident when it's bound to NF-kappa B. Otherwise, it just degrades very rapidly. So what this says is you can build a perfectly good nervous system without NF-kappa B. Because when you do sort of gross measures of behavior, or you do gross anatomy, you can't see anything wrong with these animals. But if you put them in the right learning situation, you see a big defect. And I'm not going to try to describe this system in any detail, but what you do is you put a mouse into an eight-armed maze. And you put food in four of the arms. And the animals wander around and they find the food. And once they found the food in four arms, then you take them out of there and you put food now in the arms that lacked food previously. And you put the mouse back in there. And if the mouse is smart, it now goes to the arms where it hadn't found food before. And if the mouse is naive, I don't want to call them dumb, then it'll go searching randomly. And of course, the first time you put them in there, it searches randomly. And after a while, it learns that there's a trick here. And in order to figure the trick out, the animal has to be quite conscious of the surround in order to know where the arms are that have food and where the arms are that don't. So it's actually quite a complex task involving spatial learning. If you put an NF kappa B, a wild type animal, in there, it will learn this over a series of trials. You do it every 2 days, and you test them and look for errors that they make within a given trial or between trials. You can score these in whatever way you want. I'm running on reserve power. Help. I have a plug-in. I can plug it in, but I think I'll make it. because there's a clear big difference here between the knockout animals that learn slowly, but they learn it, and the animals that, I won't go through that. This is a somewhat of a variant of it that doesn't require the same kind of spatial learning. And whereas I won't describe what it is, you can see the animals behave quite similarly. So they're able to, goodbye. No, I don't need it. That's all right. I should have plugged it in before, but I'd forgotten. So not only can we show that NF-kappa B is at the synapses, that it moves to the nucleus, that it reprograms the genes that are being expressed, but we can have a consequence for this. Consequence is that the animals learn at least complicated tasks that require hippocampal learning in particular, much more slowly than wild type. And we've done this with a lot of animals, and the statistics are very good on it. So this transcription factor, which we originally discovered because we were interested in immunity, has a much wider importance than we ever imagined before. And we're now trying to follow up on this to understand how important this is. Thank you.
I'm astonished, first of all, the final data
convinced. Oh, look, for behavioral data, I don't know if anybody in here does animal behavior work. That's good data. But I know just how you feel about it.
but if there really is a significant effect on learning, then what you said just before that, to me, is astonishing. More interesting, because you said if you look at behavior, there's no effect.
All right.
That would mean that, I mean, this, you did this change at the embryonic stage.
Yeah.
So the whole process, until they were grown mice subject to mazes, which wasn't built in, is all built in and involves no learning?
Oh, no, I didn't say it involves no learning. There are other mechanisms of learning than this. I really asked, can you show that this is involved in any learning? And the answer is yes, we can show it's involved in any learning, but the learning that we had to investigate was a fairly complicated task. It's a task that you couldn't have known the animals were unable to do by just watching them run around in a cage.
But they're able to run around in a cage,
right? They run around in a cage, they mate. All right, mating is a very complicated thing. They suckle their young, they're actually pretty good mice. But when you go into, in particular, hippocampal-dependent learning, although I don't want to say that we know that this actually involves the hippocampus, we don't. There are ways of finding that out, but we don't. Then you can see that there's a significant deficit. And the deficit is a time deficit. That is, it's not that they can't learn. It's that they learn slowly. So there have to be other ways, other pathways of learning that are not involved. That's not a surprise. Anybody who has tried to pin down a molecule to a learning process in a mouse has run into this problem, that you've got to define the characteristic that you're looking at very carefully, then you can see a deficit, but there must be many different pathways to learning. And it's interesting, we don't know anything else, however, that moves from the synapse to the nucleus, except NF-kappa B and calcium waves. What do you mean?
For example, this,
glia don't have glutamate receptors and don't respond. We have not looked in mouse models for Alzheimer's. Yeah, right, we have not. We did do LTP experiments at some length. We were never able to get the kind of robust difference that anybody was satisfied with. That may be because we weren't good enough at it. Because in most of the times when people have shown deficits due to transcription factors, it's really very late, and we weren't good enough to carry him out that long.
So if the calcium waves reach from the synapse back to the nucleus, why do you think NF can't be, what's the purpose of translocating that molecule all the way down?
They don't.
Okay.
So when you have a localized activation, if you can just puff glutamate in a specific on a couple of synapses, the calcium wave will stay within the spines. If you have a global activation, lots of synapses all at once, then you get an action potential, and now the whole cell responds. So what we're saying here, I didn't really try to go into that, but we're saying here is that the local activation would be sufficient to move NF-kappa.
So how can you rule out the requirement for NF-kappa B in either developmental event required for ammonia or a degenerative effect up until it's
right? We cannot. And you're quite right, and I really should have said that. The limitation of an experiment like this is that they never had NF-kappa B in their whole lifetime.
No, I assume there's no sort of thermal labile forms of these even.
Well, no. There are ways of doing the knockout in an adult, and we just haven't set it up yet. I mean, we're in the process of doing that. But that would clearly be a better way to do it. I wasn't going to do that until I saw this. Yeah.
Is there some way you could, this thing sort of implements the heavier role. Is there some way you could test that by seeing how the cells respond to this?
Yeah, you could set up a kind of Hebbian response system, that's not where I want to go.
But you're assuming that the message that's gotten is to reinforce that.
Yeah, I don't know that that is the only paradigm of learning. And, we've tended to look under the lamppost, LTP and whatever, which is a wonderful model. I don't want to take anything away from it. But it's clearly not the whole answer to learning in the brain. I mean, anything, one thing biologists have learned over the last 10 years is that when something is important, it's not done by one unitary mechanism. Take apoptosis, programmed cell death. We keep finding new ways that apoptosis can occur because it's a central mechanism of cell protection. So it isn't just one system, it's many different systems. There are even other systems for activating NF-kappa B, but they're only in very limited areas.
In the Witching experiment?
In the Witching experiment?
The Witching experiment of NF-kappa B.
Yes, right, yeah.
Is it diffusion in the dendrite or is it transport?
We believe it's transport. It certainly is not just diffusion. Although it could be.
Well, you could simply measure all the fault properties at the time for this.
Yeah, we haven't done that well enough to know anything. And one of the reasons is because we don't know how synchronous the release is. If it were really a synchronous wave that was moving, it'd be fine. But clearly, it takes time to activate more and more molecules. So we don't know what the concentrations are there. So we just haven't tried to do that. Well, in neurons, it takes more like half an hour to an hour.
So it takes half an hour, and then it activates certain genes.
Right.
And then how long, do you have any idea how long the change in the state of the cell persists?
if it doesn't get any more calcium activation?
Well, people have shown that a single train of activations is sufficient to get a measurable difference in the behavior of a cell. So, but you measure that sort of many, many hours later, 24 hours later or 20 hours later.
So it's basically, I mean, if you think about the learning in the brain, what the cell knows is being stimulated at least once in the last 24 hours, right?
It's Yeah, it's generally believed that it knows, that it keeps that information a lot longer than that. And what is, what's going on remains debated, as far as I can tell. but almost certainly involves a proliferation of the synaptic contacts between the activating cell and the responding cell. And once that's happened, apparently it's reasonably stable. So you're looking at actually the synthesis of a lot of new, I mean, you're looking at a response which is not just a simple biochemical response, but probably a complicated anatomic response involving a wide range of proteins that have to go up in concentration and find their way back to the site of the initial stimulation. So one of the things that the whole field is looking for now is something that marks a synapse for having been activated. So that because the proteins are being made in the cell body, all synapses should be equally bathed in them, if you wish, but only these seem to respond. Yes, right. Absolutely. And we haven't really investigated that enough in neurons, partly because it's hard to make these cultures and whatever. But in some of the cases, and I didn't really specify them all, the activation is done over less than a minute. And then everything else follows from that. And you might think that that has to be true because you now, once you degrade I-kappa-B out in the synapse, it's got to come in from the nucleus, right? So actually you have to reprogram the whole thing, get it all back out again. It's going to be, and we haven't studied that at all, but that's an important issue is how a cell recovers from activation. That's right. No, I'm trying to convince people that that's the most interesting question.
Are you thinking that maybe the fact that the NF-kappa B have locally disappeared from where the signal was marks that synapse because it's the one that has the NF-kappa B missing?
Right. That's a good thought. I have kept myself from trying to make NF-kappa B the center of all neurobiology. but it is possible.
I suggest we break for coffee now and reconvene here, whoever is interested in the discussion.